This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So this is Yawkey Way, just outside of Fenway Park on a warm summer day not too long ago. As a street band plays, baseball fans in shorts and t-shirts stroll in the sun, buy Red Sox souvenirs, maybe even a hot dog or two.
Ah, yes, a lovely summer tableau that already seems far, far away. But here's the thing. Yawkey Way is a public street in Boston, but for the last 9 years, during Red Sox home games, that street becomes an extension of Fenway Park. It gets closed off, and you can't enter unless you have a ticket to the game. In effect, Yawkey Way becomes the private property of the Red Sox, allowing the team to expand its business.
Around the corner, the Sox have cashed in on the air rights above Lansdowne Street with expensive seats atop the Green Monster. This was all made possible thanks to a deal with the Boston Redevelopment Authority, the BRA, and it's turned out pretty well for the Sox.
Really well. Thanks to that deal, the team has pocketed an extra $45 million. And what did the city get in return? A tiny fraction of that in fees, less than $200,000 a year.
This was the finding of an investigation by the Initiative for Investigative Reporting at Northeastern University, which was featured in today's Boston Globe.
It's a story that raises big questions about eminent domain, the authority of the BRA, not to mention who owns the city streets, who gets to use them to cash in. Who benefits? The city, its citizens, or the big business of professional baseball? Callum Borchers was part of the team of reporters on the story, and he joins us now. And welcome to Radio Boston, Callum. Good to have you.
Very glad to be here. Thanks.
So on the face of it, Meghna and I just laid out how this deal works. It looks like an incredible gift from the city of Boston to the Red Sox. How did this deal come about?
I think you sort of have to go back to when the Henry Ownership Group took over the team. They bought the team in late 2001 and sort of took over in 2002. And at that time, you'll recall that it seemed as though Fenway Park was on the way out. It seemed as though a new Fenway Park was going to be necessary for the continued longevity of the team. And so the plan that the Red Sox had laid out was to build a $627 million new Fenway Park, and they were asking taxpayers to pay for $275 million worth of that construction. And so there was great incentive for both this new ownership group and for the city to see if there was any way to keep the existing Fenway Park viable. And so the Red Sox presented this license agreement as an integral part of seeing whether they could, in fact, remain at Fenway Park. And so for the last month of 2002, they had sort of an experimental phase on Yawkey Way where they shut it down. They used it for concessions and souvenirs before the game. They paid only $900 a game to the city, and it seemed to work very well. At the same time, in that offseason between 2002 and 2003, they applied for a permit to build the new seating section above the Green Monster in left field. And all of these factors combined, as you said, to generate some extra revenue for the Red Sox. And at the same time, it saved the owner group and the city from having to foot a bill for a brand new ballpark.
And I guess it should be said, if you're a Red Sox fan and you go to these games, there's more room to circulate now. There are more concessions that are available to you. So it works out well for the fans as well.
There's no question. And in fact, even as Peter Mead, who is the director of the BRA, wrote to the Red Sox talking about renegotiating the contract when it expires in 2013, he described how well the arrangement has worked for both the Red Sox and for fans, and there's no doubt it was awfully tight in there beforehand.
Now, as you report, though, when you get into the intricacies of how this deal was put together, it becomes very, very interesting, because it wasn't as though the Boston Redevelopment Authority could just sort of say to the Red Sox, sure, have Yawkey Way on game day and do what you want with it. I mean, they had to fashion a deal. How did they do that?
Sure. Well, Brian Mahler wrote a good piece about this in the New England Law Review several years ago. And essentially, the Boston Redevelopment Authority declared that area around Fenway Park to be an area of urban blight. Mm. And he concluded that the BRA stretched the definition of blight.
Right.
And certainly,
because let's be clear, Yawkey Way on one side is Fenway Park. On the other, all kinds of businesses. The Boston Beer Works are down there.
Right.
It's not exactly a blighted area, right?
Certainly not as
right.
we traditionally think of the phrase. But they used that definition to justify the taking of that land on Yawkey and on Lansdowne Street by eminent domain. And then they turned over the rights to those pieces of property to the Red Sox. And then they had to come up with some sort of way to receive compensation from the Red Sox. And they hired an appraisal firm named Casey and Dennis, which had done some work for the city of Boston in the past. And Casey and Dennis took a look at Yawkey Way and Lansdowne and said, what do we think these are worth? This was a difficult process because, you know, what do you compare them to? So what the appraisers did was they looked at Yawkey Way and said, well, they'll be selling food and drink and souvenirs here. It's sort of akin to shopping malls, push carts at shopping malls. So they sort of looked at lease arrangements that shopping mall vendors have and said, that's a good basis for Yawkey Way. And then on Lansdowne Street, they looked at the property values and sales within probably a quarter mile radius of that area, and they used those figures to kind of formulate a value for those two parcels. What they did not do, however, was consider the income that the Red Sox would realize on those two properties. They did not use what's called the income appraisal method. Mm.
And that's what your investigation looks into, right? And you came up with this figure, $45 million over the 9 years or so?
Right. And we tried to be conservative as we went through those estimates. So obviously, the Red Sox books are not public, so it is an estimate. But we drew from industry experts, we drew from research and from public documents to put together the most reasonable figures that we could come up with. And that's what we decided was a reasonable estimate for the first 9 years of the deal. It's been quite a boon. Not enough, perhaps, to double the Red Sox value as they have done since the Henry ownership group, but it's been a contributing factor.
So $45 million in extra revenues, and the city got in fees about how much?
About $1.7 million.
About $1.7 million. So obviously a very good deal for the Red Sox. And this is the question that we're going to explore with a couple of different voices and listeners. We want to know what you make of this story. It seems like it comes down to a couple of big questions. Who owns the city streets and who benefits from this deal? The city, its citizens, you, if you're a city, if you're a citizen of Boston, or the big business of professional baseball? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And let me introduce Shirley Kressel. She's here in the studio with us. And Shirley was a co-founder of the Alliance of Boston Neighborhoods. And Shirley, your group was opposed to this deal. You wrote about it at the time. What was your biggest concern about it?
Well, let's just understand that the Boston Redevelopment Authority is not the city. And the city is getting nothing from this deal. The city is not getting one penny. And the renegotiation of the deal by the BRA will yield the city not one penny more.
Well, they're getting something. They're just not getting as much as the Red Sox are getting.
No, they are getting nothing. The city of Boston,
that.
Because when the mayor wants to give land, city-owned land, away to private corporations, he tells the BRA to take it, declare it blighted, and take it by eminent domain. We, as far as I have been able to determine, are the only city where the Redevelopment Authority uses its eminent domain powers to take city-owned land, publicly owned land. It was created to take privately owned land and to pay just compensation for it, as the U.S. Constitution requires. The Boston Redevelopment Authority takes city-owned land and pays the taxpayers nothing. And they do that with Menino's written permission. He lets them take it, and he lets them waive any compensation.
Mm. Well,
so this land was given away to the Redevelopment Authority. They are the gloves for the mayor's dealings with in his corporate welfare game.
Well, let me just ask you, I mean, if this deal hadn't been done, how would this land have been used in a better way, for example?
Are you against
the deal, or are you against the fact that not enough of the money that the Red Sox made came back to the city of Boston?
I'm against the taking of city-owned land for corporate purposes. This is a public street. Can any business go to the mayor and say, you know, we kind of need some more money, so can we close off this street and use it for our private business, to sell things, to park cars? And the mayor will say, well, we'll tell the Boston Redevelopment Authority to take it with some bogus appraisal, and then they can get a kickback from you. You can give them a few bucks, whatever you guys figure out, like they're doing now. And the city street is given away. That belongs to the taxpayer.
Okay, a couple of things. We did ask members of the Boston Redevelopment Authority to join us today. They declined. They did issue a statement. I'm going to read just a part of it. The city has benefited from additional real estate taxes, more jobs, and additional spending in the immediate area and the entire city. All of the Red Sox's economic impact was factored into our thinking. The statement also went on to say that the BRA has already notified the Red Sox that we seek to begin negotiations for a new license agreement prior to the expiration of 2013. Callum Borchers, let me ask you, does that suggest that the city will look for a better deal?
That's what Peter Mead has indicated.
Yeah.
And I think
the head of the BRA.
The head of the BRA, right. Who was not the head of the BRA at the time that the deal was negotiated in 2003. That was Mark Maloney. So Peter Mead has expressed to us that one of the things he did when he took over the BRA was to sort of look at all the license agreements that the group had and see which ones might not be generating as much revenue as they possibly could. His explanation was that at the time in 2003, we didn't know how successful these projects would be by the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. You've got to remember the first year of those monster seats, they went for $50 a piece. Mm-hmm. Today, those seats are $165 a piece. So the value has increased greatly over that time. You could argue whether or not that was foreseeable, but, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt, they didn't know how valuable it would be. And now the Red Sox realize how good it is, and so does the BRA, and they want a bigger piece of the pie.
Listeners,
but you have to.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry,
you
Shirley.
You have to listen. The BRA is going to get more money. The city of Boston will not. Schools, libraries, roads, snow plowing, none of that will see one penny of this, even if the BRA becomes a full joint venture partner in this, as they have in other private developments.
Let's try to get some listeners into the call. We're asking what you make of this story. Who owns the city streets? And do you think this is a good deal for the city of Boston? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Ethan, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Ethan.
How's it going today?
Very well.
The first thing I'd like to point out is that Fenway Park is the most expensive, costly park of any in the entire nation. So the Red Sox are doing very well and charging a very high premium. And I think the more important issue is that this should not be up to a private development or a semi-private development authority. This is up to the citizens, and we're not going to get any of that money back. And many states have gone in these joint ventures with car companies trying to attract businesses, and they always end up coming up short, and no one actually ever shows that this actually helps the overall city or state.
Well, Ethan, you raise some great points, and we want to chew on them. Thanks very much for your call. Let me introduce one more guest. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College, and he's looked at these kinds of deals across the country and joins us now from Smith College. And Andrew Zimbalist, good to have you.
Thank you.
So you've been listening to this conversation. I know you know something about this. Does this sound like a good deal to you?
I think that the package that the city of Boston has with the Red Sox is one of the best packages in Major League Baseball, and in fact all the professional sports. As Callum said at the beginning of his discussion, the alternative was to build a new stadium that would have required about $300 million of public money just for the stadium alone. There would have been infrastructure spending as well. The Red Sox have put about $250 million of their own money into the renovation of Fenway Park. The land that we're talking about, the air rights on Lansdowne and the cordoning off for roughly 6-7 hours on 81 days a year of Yawkey Way, is something that benefits not only the fans, but it benefits the city.
How does it do that?
In a number of ways. One way is that there's a 7% sales tax that goes to the city and the state from the concession sales. Another is that the property value at Fenway Park has gone up 3 times, and the Red Sox are paying almost $3 million a year in property tax, which is very unusual for a professional sports team. If there were a new stadium built down the street, like Mr. Harrington was seeking at the end of the 90s and the beginning of the aughts, it would have been a publicly owned stadium, most likely, and there wouldn't have been any property taxes. Another way that the city benefits is that people come to the ballpark earlier on summer days, and that distributes the traffic flow more evenly over the course of a couple of hours before the game. The Fans benefit enormously from the atmosphere around the park. Most teams actually have control over concessions that are on the land immediately adjacent to their ballpark.
Well, so Andrew Zimlis, I wanted to ask you about how it works in other cities, because I think on the face of it, what the average citizen might have a problem with are just these numbers. I mean, $45 million in extra revenue and less than $200,000 a year going to the city.
The article that you're featuring right here begins the article in the first paragraph by juxtaposing a nine-year sum to $45 million with a yearly sum of rent. What kind of a comparison is that? Why not compare year to year instead of a nine-year sum to a one-year sum?
Well, then let's compare 9 years to 9 years. So nine times 200,000 is, 1.8 million. 1.8 million versus 45 million over 9 years. I mean, that's still quite a discrepancy. Do I have those figures right, Callum?
It's about 1.7. It increased. It started at 165,000 and then increased yearly with the consumer price index.
Last year went up to 201,000. I'm just pointing out that the focus of this article is stilted. You begin an article in the first paragraph and it compares those two kinds of numbers. It makes some statement about Van Ness also being part of this agreement, and it's not. Van Ness was actually given by Tom Yawkey to the city of Boston for $1 in return for the understanding that the Red Sox would be able to use Van Ness.
Just to clarify, public documents tell a slightly different story about Van Ness. That's sort of the Red Sox lore. But in fact, if you look at Registry of Deeds records, there's nothing to suggest that there was an agreement from the 1940s that allowed the Red Sox to use Van Ness Street on game days. The city, in fact, took that by a taking, and they have an easement now on that property. And there is a 1993 BTD agreement that closes the street, but again, there's no mention of a right for the Red Sox to use the street.
I don't want to get too bogged down in too many of the details of this story, because otherwise I think we're going to lose sort of the larger perspective. Shirley Kressel, let me come back to you, though. Andrew Zimbalist, I think, made a number of points there, but this idea that the Red Sox add an awful lot of economic vitality to the city and neighborhood, isn't that worth something for the residents of this?
It's business. They could have done this all on their own. They could sell their hot dogs on the sidewalks with licensed vendors like they did before, like the one that sued them, actually. There's no indication that any of this, any public subsidy would ever have been necessary if they wanted to move the ballpark. Just the fact that they demanded $250 million for moving the ballpark doesn't mean that we were under any obligation to give it to them. They also, by the way, condemned the whole Fenway neighborhood. They had it actually condemned legislatively so they could move the ballpark into the neighborhood and build humongously profitable towers on the ballpark.
You're talking about a different ownership group, ma'am. That's the Yawkey ownership group that you're discussing now.
Well, I'm saying that all of these scenarios that we had to help them or else we'd have to pay more and now look all they've done for us, none of these scenarios are real motivators for anything here. All that happens is the Red Sox guys go in and have breakfast with the mayor. And they say, here's a way that we could make a lot of money. And one of these days when you need a few bucks for one of your favorite charities, we'll throw it in, like the $25,000 they gave him for his gun buyback program.
Approximately 65% of capital costs to build stadiums and professional baseball are funded by public funds. The Red Sox have funded the renovation of Fenway with private money. $250 million. That's fine that you say that, but they're competing in a league with 29 other teams where the average is 65% public funding.
Interesting.
You mean the Red Sox need help from the citizens of Boston?
Okay, Shirley, I think
with a 20% poverty rate?
This is a good argument, and we're just going to leave it on the table. I want to get some more callers in. Dan is calling from Brookline. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air, Dan, if you can hear us.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. The only question I had was, what happened to all those independent peanut vendors and sausage vendors and everyone else that used to set up their carts on Yawkey Way and Lansdowne Street? prior to them taking over that space?
Well, that's a good question, Dan. Yeah, Dan, it's a good question, and let me put it to Callum Borchers. Callum, what do we know about the other independent folks that aren't there anymore?
Yeah, it is a great question. We had a chance to speak with some of those folks as we worked on this story. There are 16, I believe, private vendors around Fenway Park. Some of them used to set up shop along the portion of Yawkey Way that is now closed off and exclusive only to the Red Sox concessionaire Aramark. So the private vendors are still there, but they were pushed off of that main part of Yawkey Way. So some of them are now at the corner of Yawkey and Van Ness, or maybe they're on Lansdowne Street, or they're on Ipswich Street. So they're still there, but they've been moved away from some of those prime locations.
Let's go to Ernestine, who's calling from Danvers. Hi, Ernestine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
My comment is I wanted to go to one of the souvenir shops that's on Yawkey Way, which is a private business, I believe. And because I didn't have a game day ticket, they wouldn't let me have access to the store.
Well, that's pretty much the way.
That's a problem.
You think that's a problem, right? And that's a problem because you feel that it's unfair because only folks with a ticket can go there, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right. I don't know, Andrew Zimbalist, I don't know if you want to chime in and respond to Ernestine or Callum, but that this does seem to be the what people find upsetting. You know, 5 days out of six or 6 days out of seven, it's a public road, and then suddenly it's not.
The cordon functions for 6 or 7 hours, roughly 81 days a year. That's true. It enables the Red Sox not only to create the entertainment that's created outside the ballpark to enhance the atmosphere around the game, but it also enables them to facilitate ticket sales in a way that they couldn't before. You know, Fenway is the smallest footprint of any stadium in Major League Baseball.
And that had a lot to do with why the Red Sox wanted to do this, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, yes, is there a small price that some individuals pay because during those 6 or 7 hours on the 81 days a year that they can't get into a couple of stores? I guess that's a fair point.
Hmm.
I think the response is that it's a very small inconvenience for the benefit that accrues to the city, to the fans, and to the Red Sox.
Andrew Zimbalist, let me ask you this. I mean, you've looked at the way these deals work in other cities around the country, and I'm curious. As we noted, the BRA has already notified the Red Sox that they want to begin negotiations for a new license agreement. Is it normal that in these kinds of deals, as time moves on and people take a look at the profits, that they can sort of go back to the table and say, hey, the city can say, we want you to give us more, for example?
Actually, what's happened in Major League Baseball is that lease rentals around stadiums have gone down over time. Rental rates used to be much, much higher. And they're not at all based upon the revenue that's generated in the ballpark.
Hmm, interesting. I would think that they would be. I don't understand that.
Well, they're not. Hmm. What happens is that a practice gets established, and then teams want to be treated as well as the other teams they're competing against. And so if some teams are able to drive down the rent, other teams want lower lease prices as well. A lot of this started with the 1986 Tax Act, and it created a situation where rental prices were driven down.
Mm. Callum Borchers, from the reporting that you did, what kind of precedent does this set for the future, this kind of deal? Did you or your reporting team sort of take on that question or consider that?
No, actually, but it's an excellent question, and Andrew makes some excellent points about the overall state of baseball agreements around the country. The Red Sox are hardly the exception to the rule here. There's no question that cities go out of their way largely to accommodate the teams, and that some of the other arrangements are very, very sweet indeed. So for the precedent that the Red Sox set, I don't know that I could say that it will be a too huge a factor simply because there are so many others that are looking very similar. I think that the precedent has been set specifically here in Boston for the Red Sox to get some pretty favorable treatment on these two streets. I think we'll all be curious to see what the BRA negotiates for this extension in the years after 2013 when this one expires.
Well, that's clearly the next phase of the story that will follow. Callum Borchers, thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Callum Borchers, a reporter at the Initiative for Investigative reporting at Northeastern University. His story is on the front page of the Boston Globe today, and you can find a link to it at radioboston.org. Andrew Zimbalist, sports economist at Smith College, thank you for your input today. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
And Shirley Kressel, co-founder of the Alliance of Boston Neighborhoods, thanks for making the trip in here. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, summertime, Provincetown drag performer Varla Jean Merman comes to Boston to play Mother Superior in The Divine Sister. That's coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.